Chapter 9 Joyful Destiny. He spoke kindly, yet with restraint. "I was with you," he then told me calmly, "in every one of your vision memories. What a long path we have walked together. What shall we do about it now, beloved of my soul?" I blinked back the tears from my eyes. He had shared my memories, but of course he would have done so. He would have had to share them. "In that case," I said with surging heart's feelings, "we must continue to walk consciously together." "Yes," he said calmly. "I, in this life, however, have already gone farther than you. I would like for us to walk side by side." "What have you done that has enabled you to precede me?" I asked. "I have studied under a great spiritual teacher. He put me through fire. Few of his students passed his tests. I grieve at the thought that you might not pass them either. Yet I know you are strong in yourself and deeply dedicated to God. The thought of losing you makes me almost quiver with apprehension. Yet, if you would be my equal in this, as in all things, I shall have to entrust you first to his care. Are you willing?" "You are asking me, am I afraid? When necessity calls, what room is there for fear? What I must do, I will do. Never considering the dangers. The quest for God is not for cowards and weaklings. It is for those who have the courage to cry, 'I want you alone. I will accept no alternative. For me, no alternative exists.' Then your next step will have to be," I shudder to think of it, "his monastery in France. For a time, we must be parted. I hope the time will be short, for my own further progress, too, demands the harmonizing influence now of your support." I left my hands in his for another moment. The fact that he had held them gave me a sense of peace and security. "Sometimes, on a long walk through field and forest," I said softly, "one may miss the road home. I am glad to know now which path to follow." "Yes," he interrupted me, "one is glad to know." He let go my hands and turned away, shading his eyes from the glare of gold which now spread over the heavens, turning the waters of Loch Coruisk to a tawny orange against the black purple of the surrounding hills. "I see our men," he said then in a tone more ordinary. "They are looking for us. Shall we go?" My heart beat quickly. A longing to speak what I hardly dared even think was strong upon me. But I was resolved. Whatever it took to find the perfection of love in God was my only possible path. I must learn to love not only my twin soul, but all creatures made by God, even ants, flies, scorpions. "Has this day not been something more than beautiful?" I asked, and my voice trembled in spite of myself. "To you as well as to me?" He met my earnest gaze with a sudden deeper light in his own eyes. "Dearest," he said, "to me it is the beginning of a new life. But whether it is the same for you, I cannot say. I have not the right to think so far. Come." He took my hand in his as before and guided me carefully over the slippery stones and boulders, wet with the overflow of the mountain torrent, and warning us of the stream's vicinity to a quantity of bog myrtle, which grew profusely everywhere. In silence, we reached the shore where the launch lay waiting for us. In silence still, we climbed in, and sat together in the stern. The boat cut its swift way through little waves of molten gold and opal sparkling with the iridescent reflections of the sun's afterglow. "I see Mr. Harlan's yacht has returned to her moorings," said Santoris to his men after a while. "When did she come back?"
"Immediately after you left, sir," was the reply.
I looked and saw the two yachts, the Dream and the Diana, anchored in the widest part of Loch Scavaig, the yacht with the disfiguring funnels that made even its magnificence unsightly by comparison with any sailing vessel. The other yacht, a perfect picture of lightness and grace, resting like a bird with folded wings on the glittering surface of the water. As the launch rushed onward, and we lost sight of the entrance to what, for me, had been a veritable valley of remembrance, it seemed that I had lived centuries rather than hours. One thing lingered, however. With each passing moment, I was coming to know Santoris better. Growingly familiar to me now were the flash of his blue eyes, his sudden smile, the turn of his head, every gesture of his hand. All these were becoming as familiar to me as the reflection of my own face in a mirror. And now there was no wonderment mingled with the deepening recognition. I found it quite natural that I should know him well. Indeed, it was evident to me that I had known him forever. I looked at him, half in appeal, as he sat in the boat with his head turned a little aside from me. He seemed to be grave and preoccupied. A sudden thrill of emotion stirred in my heart, and tears sprang so copiously to my eyes that for a moment I could scarcely see the waves that glittered and danced on all sides of us like millions of diamonds. A change had swept into my life, a change so great that I could hardly bear it. It was too swift, too overpowering to be considered calmly, and I was glad when we came alongside the Dream, and I spied Mr. Harlan on the deck, waiting for us at the top of the companion ladder.
"Well," he called to me, "was it a good sunset?"
"Glorious," I answered. "Did you see nothing of it?"
"No," he replied. "I slept soundly and only woke up when Braille came over to explain that Catherine had taken it into her head to have a short cruise, that he had humored her accordingly, and that they had just come back to Anchorage."
By this time I was standing beside him, and Santoris joined us.
"So your doctor came to look after you," he said with a smile. "I thought he would not trust you too long out of his sight." "I'll tell you something, Santoris," said Harlan. "Your medicine has done me such wonders that I've decided to place myself under your medical care. What have you to say about that?"
"A journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step," Santoris answered calmly. "You place a great burden on me, for you are, in fact, very ill. But I promise you, I will do my best." Harlan's face lightened and he laughed.
"I own that you have been a better physician than Dr. Braille. It is months since I have been so free from pain."
"I'm very glad," Santoris answered. "And now, would you and your friend like to take the launch back to your own yacht? Or will you stay here and dine with me?" Mr. Harlan thought a moment.
"I'm afraid we must go," he said at last, with obvious reluctance. "Captain Derrick went back with Braille. You see, Catherine is not strong, and she has not been quite herself. We must not leave her alone."
"How many knots in that sentence!" exclaimed Santoris. "You must learn to take a positive view of life."
"I understand," said Harlan, "and I will try. But it is not easy to change the habits of a lifetime." I made arrangements to leave the Harlands as soon as possible. At Portree, I left the luxurious Diana for the ordinary passenger steamer, plying from there to Glasgow.